coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Healthcare payers and providers in the first state are part of an effort to see if there's a link between the pandemic and a decrease in preterm births.
Like any good research project, we're not sure we're going to get to gold, but we will find out something that's going to be important, and we're going to find out something important that's going to help all of us.
We talked to Dr. Jay Greenspan with the Moores Children's Health System about that research. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also update efforts to use wastewater analysis to track COVID-19. Art's Playlist tells us about comic books telling the stories of President Biden and Vice President Harris. And Enlighten Me features student stories from our collaboration with Mount Pleasant High School. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Healthcare payers and providers in the first state recently launched a regional partnership to find out if there's a link between the COVID-19 pandemic and a decrease in preterm births. A $300,000 grant from Highmark Delaware and other healthcare payers is funding research at the Moores Children's Health System, as well as Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and Yale and Northwestern Universities. Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino recently spoke with Nemours neonatologist Dr. Jay Greenspan about the collaboration and the upcoming research.
So when COVID hit, people started to socially isolate. We heard rumors that nurseries were getting quiet, right? And didn't make any sense. You know, these women were pregnant way before COVID was even a rumor. And why would preterm birth rates start to drop? And we started to see in Europe, same thing. So there was actually a publication, specifically Scandinavia, that said early on, in somewhere in May, that preterm birth was dropping, and they actually speculated it was because there was less handshaking, right? So less sharing of bacteria that can cause preterm birth. That was their speculation. We had other theories. There's lots of theories, but no one had any proof. So I was CEO at the time, interim CEO at Nemours, and I had developed a friendship with the CEO of Highmark, Nick Morielli. And I called him up to say, we're seeing this, you know, just as one of my, and part of my conversation with him, I'd have a regular one, and I said, we're starting to see this. Preterm birth rate drop anecdotally, wouldn't it be nice if we knew? And by the way, you have a huge database. Can we figure it out? He was like, wow, that's pretty interesting. It's interesting for two reasons. One is it's just interesting to see if it really was happening. We didn't have great data. And secondly, it was interesting because if there was a magic sauce that we have missed for 30 years, if wearing a mask prevents preterm birth rate, we're going to wear a mask. It's been that big a problem. I mean, it's a multi-billion dollar problem in this country, preterm birth. So, of course, Nick, being an insurance CEO, was interested. And as a human being, he was interested. And I was, too. And we sort of thought about how to do this. I will say that, in general, insurance companies and hospitals are not friends. But I learned in my year as interim CEO that that's just not necessary, and it's not really true. I mean, it's everyone has a mission of trying to make health better, and we just go about it with different tools and different ways. But really, when you get to know the leadership of companies like Highmark, and they're good people, and they want the same thing we do. And so in further conversation, he agreed, what would you do given, you know, what could I do to support your effort to try to figure out whether preterm birth is actually dropping? And I phoned my friends, right? So I have a lot of friends, and, you know, I'm old. So I have a lot of friends in neonatology that have explored preterm birth. And I've done some of it myself to try to get to an answer. So these have to be really good social scientists, people that know how to take data, large databases, and work them and come up with solutions. There's a young group at CHOP that I've known well. They've spoken at some of the conferences I run. That's where Heather Burroughs was called there's Jimmy Collins from Northwestern and Jen Culhane from Yale. These people are world-renowned at great institutions that have never worked together and certainly have never worked together with an insurance company. But we made it happen. So we had a couple of calls, and it was just one of those where everything was a yes. You know, there's no roadblocks. Could we work together? Yes. Could we? Could you get data from Highmark? They've never done it before. But Nick would double down, which is what I love about Nick. He would say, not only can I get Highmark of Delaware, but probably Highmark of PA and maybe Highmark of where else, and maybe even Independence Blue Cross in Pennsylvania. And he did all that, right? So he phoned his friends. And so it was all this really cool coming together to try to get the data. The good news on this, Nick, is that we did come together. He did generate a grant. It was a $300,000 grant split by Independence Blue Cross and himself, his company, Highmark of Delaware. And that money has been funneled through CHOP because we wanted to pick one place. I'll tell you why we did that. The bad news is we don't have the answer yet. It's taken us this long, and we're probably going to have the answer in a month or two, whether preterm birth rate dropped and why. By the way, if we can figure out the preterm birth rate dropped, it'd be nice to know more about it. You know, so it's not just a simple numbers game. It's, you know, was it all across all race ethnicities? Was it across all socioeconomic issues? Was it all across all areas, right? So this is a pretty broad national database. We could tell, you know, if it worked in Pennsylvania but not in Delaware, if it, you know, by specific populations, that will be really important because that can get to, if it did drop, why did it drop? Did it pick certain populations? Some of the theories, for instance, is places that had higher COVID maybe didn't social distance enough and maybe they didn't have it drop. Could it be that single mom? So we know that preterm birth is related to stress. Higher stress causes preterm birth, and that's why racism causes preterm birth, because that's a chronic stressor. And so the question is, would a single mom who's at home with a mom without any kids, meaning single first child, who's at home, you know, working from home, maybe on Zoom, have a very low stress. I'm pregnant. I'm glad I'm home. I don't have to. Maybe that would have a nice decrease in preterm birth. Whereas the mom who's at home, who's still working, has three kids, maybe that stress level went up. And so we're trying to look at, you know, all those factors to try to get to it. So like any good research project, we're not sure we're going to get to gold. But we will find out something that's going to be important, and we're going to find out something important that's going to help all of us Americans, maybe beyond, you know, improve health of kids. And that's because of this incredible collaboration.
Now the collaboration is together. You mentioned your ability to research data, but how do you research on the ground level to find those similarities in cases where preterm birth has dropped so that you can draw conclusions?
Right. So that's where the great data miners come in, right? So we're going to get very large sheets of data from Highmark, and the team that's primarily focused from CHOP will analyze it to find the signals. So the first big one is, did preterm birth drop? By the way, even if it didn't drop, there's still going to be important information because we know that people were treated differently during COVID. Women had less prenatal care, had fewer ultrasounds. We're going to see all that in the data, and we're going to know, did that make a difference? Wouldn't it be amazing if, you know, well, you don't need as many ultrasounds, you can still have just as good outcome thing. So we're not going to stop, and just getting that access to the data will allow us to begin to answer questions that we've had for a long time. And what I also hope for the future is that this data will, as all good research does, it will stimulate other questions, and then we will get more data. And this partnership, we hope, will continue. But to answer the question specifically, We're creating a hypothesis together. We meet every week. We're creating the hypothesis together, and then we're going to pull the data points specifically to answer that. So mostly demographics, like I mentioned, meaning, you know, how old mom is, you know, what all of her characteristics. And then did she have COVID? You know, try to figure out, you know, when she had a baby and how the baby did. And all those characteristics are sheets and sheets of important information.
Now, earlier you mentioned the handshaking part or hypothesis. Are there any other ideas out there as to why a pandemic might be linked to a drop in the number of preterm births?
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, masking and social distancing in and of itself has dropped flu, for instance. So flu is almost non-existent this year, and that may have decreased preterm birth because your moms are not getting sick with other things or even sharing bacteria or viruses that may relate to preterm birth. We think that, as I mentioned, it may be decreased attention. So, you know, maybe we spend too much time in the, you know, worrying about the clinical scenarios, and maybe we are doing too much intervention. That would be amazing, right? So we think we're doing the right thing. We think we, you know, you need all this prenatal care. Maybe you need some, and maybe not. You don't need some. So OBs were specifically saying stay at home unless something is really coming up. That's really a shift. That's one of our doctor's theories. And then there's all sorts of other nuances of, you know, like we talked about, you know, work from home might be very helpful to decrease your stress. You know, there may be something about just how we know everything's changed with COVID. Something in there may have been keying us to have decreased preterm birth. So, you know, again, it's really going to be important to figure out if we have it. And if we do, then try to get some data as to why. We might not have a why. We may have just guesses, but we're going to try.
So where are you at now as far as getting the project underway, and what kind of timeline are you working on?
Right. So some of the challenges has been to get the contracts all done. So there's a lot of data sharing that we have to be very careful with. Right. So that's, you know, we want to protect people from, you know, privacy and all that. So we've had to really set up these walls of carefully constructed data sets so that no one could ever identify who we're talking about, even the researchers. And that's taken a lot of time. It's also taken some time to get the contracts all settled and the money in the right place. But we're really close now. And by the way, we're not going to ask for all the data from Highmark, right, or Independence. We're asking for specific things, and we had to come up with what those specific questions were, specific demographics. We're not going to just grab their entire database and work on it. So all those took time. We're really close. So I'm told that we will start looking at data by the end of February. And it, once we do that, it shouldn't take long, a month or two to know what we're to have a signal of what we're seeing. And then we have a really good team of writers, so we're going to try to put it out. I'll give you a call, let you know how it's going.
Yeah, I look forward to that.
And so do we. We are all as excited as everybody else. We're excited. I'm personally excited by the collaboration. I hope it continues, but I'm also excited about, you know, could we really make a difference here? Could we really finally figure out what's going on with preterm birth?
And if you did have some kind of breakthrough information that came out of this study, what would then be next?
So we want to be able to translate that to, you know, after COVID, how do we treat each other so that we can reduce our preterm birth? If we find a signal, you know, what was that special sauce? What was the silver lining of COVID that caused preterm birth rates to go down? Look, if it's just stopping handshaking, that'll be our advice. When you're pregnant, don't shake anybody's hand. I don't think it's going to come down to that. But, you know, that it could be as simple as that. We're hoping for a simple answer to help turn this really national tragedy of preterm birth into down into a, you know, slowly improving outcome. We may not get that lucky, but it's really worth the grant to spend the time to look at it.
Thanks to Nemours neonatologist Dr. Jay Greenspan and Arnick Shalino for their time on The Green this week. Next, we have an update on how Newcastle County is using wastewater analysis to track the spread of COVID-19. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Last spring, we brought you an interview with the co-founder of a startup working with Newcastle County to analyze its sewer water for evidence of COVID-19. Newcastle County is still attempting to track the virus through its wastewater, but during the latter months of last year, the county transitioned from working with BioBot Analytics to working with a center at the University of Delaware. County officials say the Center for Environmental and Wastewater-Based Epidemiological Research, or SEWER, can do the job faster and cheaper. SEWER is now analyzing samples from most of Newcastle County, as well as from the University of Delaware campus. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with UD Professor of Microbial Food Safety and SEWER Director, Callie Neal, about the partnerships.
How is it that there becomes evidence of COVID in a sewer, and how can you guys detect that?
Sure. So we are using the same testing protocol as BioBot was. And what's very interesting is there are scientists around the world all using basically the same methodology looking for this virus. It's a pretty seamless process. We take the water that's collected by Newcastle County, and then we put that through a pasteurization process. And BioBot was doing this as well, where you can inactivate any virus that's there. Then we filter it and concentrate the virus. There's so little virus that's there, we have to concentrate it so that it'll make detection possible. And then we go through an extraction process so we can extract the nucleic acid, the genetic material that's there from the virus. And that's really what we're testing for. We're looking to see if the genetic material of the virus is there. And we do that using polymerase chain reaction, which is almost identical to what's happening if you go in for a clinical test. And one thing I think that's important to note is that while people are being infected by this virus, SARS-CoV-2 that causes COVID-19, is really an upper respiratory virus. It can be shed in both feces and urine, but most likely the virus that's being shed is not infectious originally. It's just something that we're able to detect in the environment, and that's really a benefit of wastewater analysis, sort of equivalent to obtaining community-based urine and fecal samples. And that has provided scientists and public health with information for many years now on a lot of different viruses, as well as chemicals like opioids. You can even detect caffeine in wastewater. So it's pretty telling of what's happening within a public community.
So you're working with the university's wastewater, as well as Newcastle County's. How are these partners using the data? I know there's been some talk about, you know, this technique being able to sort of predict spikes. You know, if you see a spike in the wastewater, you might be seeing a spike in actual clinical tests a couple days later. Is that something that's really played out?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So we've been making an attempt to make those connections, those correlations. And what we saw, so we do have the dashboard that's available through Newcastle County, has all of the wastewater data. And you can look at the data based on different sites, different sampling sites, or you can look at, say, the Wilmington area, which has a great amount of people. That's the largest population. And if you look at that information and then you compare that to a rolling day average, for example, of clinical cases, you can see the wastewater virus data pick up. And then after that, you would see the clinical data rise. And we're working on how to directly compare that information given our specific populations. It is more complicated with smaller populations. We've seen success done in Arizona, in Colorado, maybe where they have larger populations of people that they're dealing with. So we're still working on how to make those best connections. What we were able to do with the university is design areas for sampling where students were living. So this past fall semester, we had fewer students on campus, and we set up specifically collection sites where we had fairly good populations of students, you know, 100 or more, 200 students in some cases living in a facility. And what we were able to do is then identify where we found virus and then communicate that to student health and work with student health to try to figure out if there were individuals there that should go for clinical testing or may have been positive for the virus. So that is one limitation of looking for the virus in wastewater, is you don't know if it's a new case or is this representative of cases that have people who have already recovered from their illness.
How certain are you that, you know, X amount of virus found in the water correlates to X amount of humans that have the virus?
Right. That is really tricky to do. We can say for certain how much virus we're finding, but we don't know how that correlates to specific individuals. Scientists around the world are really looking at these same questions, trying to understand how much virus is shed by different people at different points of their infection process. Sometimes children may shed different amounts of virus than adults, for example. And so there's a lot of variation in that data itself. But that's when we put it together in larger watersheds with lots of people, and then we can make more sense out of that data.
Okay, so I guess you can still take, you know, a certain wastewater system and compare it to itself over time, but you can't necessarily say that we're going to see 200 new cases next week because of this.
Absolutely. And that's really the best thing that it's used for. If we're trying to do trend analysis, we're trying to look at what's happening over time. I think in the future, I'm going to be very optimistic and hopeful that as we see implementation and use of vaccines, and we continue to see people taking the right precautions in terms of wearing masks and continuing to distance themselves, we're going to see virus go down, virus cases go down. And then the wastewater analysis is going to be particularly useful because as cases start to go down, we'll be able to see when cases go up in terms of wastewater. We may also be able to see whether or not people are protected by the vaccine and are not shedding the virus as much. So I think in the next few months, the data we get from wastewater analysis is going to be particularly interesting and useful.
So in terms of those policies, the mitigation measures, is the center tracking how those correlate with impacts to the wastewater?
Yeah, so this is a project that we are working on with the Delaware Data Innovation Lab. And members of that group are outstanding with this type of data analysis. They are leading the way in looking at analyzing these different mitigation steps. And so we'll really try to understand which ones had more of an impact on public health, at least in terms of how much virus we identified as circulating in the environment.
So is the State Division of Public Health using your data? Do you think that they should be?
We would love to work more closely with State Division of Public Health. They certainly are very busy right now dealing with vaccination, and that's an incredibly important thing for them to be doing. And so I'm really glad that they are focused on the vaccine drive and those initiatives, and we look forward to continuing conversations with them in the future.
Callie Neal, Professor of Microbial Food Safety and Director of the Center for Environmental and Wastewater-Based Epidemiological Research, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sophia. State Division of Public Health Medical Director Dr. Rick Hong said in a statement that analyzing wastewater could provide, quote, some insight into possible outbreak monitoring, unquote, but that there are still many logistical questions to be answered. Hong says DPH is aware of sewer's work, but is not formally partnered with the center. He adds sewer is still in its early phases of exploratory work, and the state is still responding to more immediate public needs in the COVID-19 response. And stay with us. The Green continues with Art's Playlist and our conversation with an author bringing President Biden's story to comic book form. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A Vancouver-based multimedia production company specializes in telling politician stories in comic books. Tidal Wave Comics has profiled politicians in comic book form for over a decade, and now it's featuring President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris in its Political Power series. Political Power, President Joe Biden, and Political Power, Madam Vice President Kamala Harris, were released on Inauguration Day last month. Michael Frizzell wrote both, and in this week's Arts Playlist, he chats with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about these comic books.
Michael, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me today.
Hey, let's talk about Tidal Wave Comics. And first of all, before we talk about the latest Political Power, President Joe Biden, and Political Power, Madam Vice President Kamala Harris, let's talk about the Political Power series in general. What's it all about?
The series is about trying to get the stories of politicians out in a more maybe a popular format, an easier to access format for people of all ages. The publisher likes to talk about how he was a recalcitrant reader and comic books really drew him in and really caused him to start working in comic book business in the first place. And I feel the same way. And I really like the idea of taking the true stories of people who shape our politics and maybe distill that into some ways that, are a little more accessible to just almost anyone. So what I'm trying to say is that these are not political in the sense that we're advocating for blue or red or, you know, conservative or whatever. What we're trying to do is just tell the stories of real people.
Michael, when did the Political Power series actually start? How many years ago?
And, you know, I believe that it predates me working with the company. So I think it was about a decade or more ago. And I think the first comic that they produced was on Hillary Clinton. And he was interviewed on CNN, the publisher. And Hillary Clinton signed a copy for him. And it was a really big deal. And it kind of kicked off the series. And it's been going steady ever since.
All right. So Political Power, President Joe Biden, was released on Inauguration Day, January 20th. Joe Biden, we're talking to you from his home state of Delaware. He is right. Our 46th president. Let's talk about the series. What can we expect if we look at this comic book?
This one, but the Biden comic was originally published maybe a year or two ago, maybe a little longer. Another writer had picked it up and told his life story about some of the struggles that he went through early in his life. You know, his first wife, the car crash, the loss that he suffered. And it showed him propelling through his career. And then as a writer, I was asked to come in, reshape the narrative to fit a more modern update, and then add pages to show where he is now. And so this brings us the comic all the way from his beginnings all the way until Election Day.
Michael,
yes, go ahead.
Are there any areas of Delaware highlighted in the comic book?
You know, that one I haven't worked on in a few months, so it's been a while. I believe some of the areas, of course, are going to be the state itself. There's a lot of mention of the Capitol and, you know, riding the train into Washington and these sorts of things. But I don't remember off the top of my head exactly any landmarks that we might mention in the comic.
All right. We're talking to the author of two new comic books put out by Tidal Wave Comics. Tidal Wave Comics is based in Vancouver, Washington, and it really builds on the Political Power series, as you just heard the author say, started probably more than 10 years ago, focused on political figures around the world. Those latest two political figures are Delaware Joe, President Joe Biden, the brand new president of the United States, 46th president. And there's another comic book called Political Power, Madam Vice President Kamala Harris. They were both released on Inauguration Day, January 20th. So let's talk about Madam Vice President Kamala Harris and that comic book.
That one was a lot of fun. And when I started working on that book, she had almost dropped out of the race at that point. And we had no idea that she was going to get picked up as vice president. At the time, when we started working with this year's crop of political hopefuls, we started looking at those the publisher felt would continue in the national conversation. So during that, there was about a 4-month period where I wrote a comic book on Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris. I started working on Stacey Abrams and a couple others that seemed to be movers and shakers within the Democratic side. 4 years ago, we focused on the Republican side. So I wrote a comic on Donald Trump, for instance. So when we started developing this comic, I wanted to tell the story of her childhood and kind of what shaped her and makes her think the way she does. So that's kind of the heart of these comics, is trying to get to the real person, not to just the politics, and then let you as a reader decide how you feel about this person. And in the case of Kamala Harris, it was interesting because as soon as Joe Biden picked her up as his running mate, we had to reshape the narrative as the art was happening. So that was a little hectic near the end. And as soon as the election was called and it was clear that she was going to be a historical vice president, we added more pages to this book. So we were able to get it out to press a lot bigger than most of our comics and has a lot of information about her, everything from her childhood all the way through to the election.
Are these latest comic books geared towards children more than adults, Michael?
You know, when I think of it as a writer, I try to think of it as who would be interested in reading about Kamala Harris or Joe Biden. And I don't writing for children has a connotation that maybe you're dumbing down language or that your sentences are constructed differently so that children can easily access it. I think if you wanted to look at a readability, I'm talking probably middle school, 12, 13 years old, all the way through to adults.
What else can you tell me about this latest series? We're so excited here in Delaware because Joe Biden is from here. So we all want to pick up these comic books. Maybe answer that. Where can we get these comic books?
Well, they're available just about anywhere digital comics are sold if you wanted a digital copy. But a lot of people prefer the print copies. And there are a couple places you can go. I know for a fact that they're on Amazon and they use Ingram printing. And so they're really nice square bound hardcovered comics. They're really well done. You can also get them through comicfleamarket.com if you wanted physical copies.
Anything else about the series that you want readers to know about before we rush to order our copies?
Sure. You know, whenever Tidal Wave approached me about writing these comics, one of the things that always concerns me is, now, I teach at a university here in the Midwest, and I don't want my students to really pick up on my politics. And when we started talking and I started negotiating contracts and things, I said, what is your goal here? And he said, I want to keep them positive. I want to keep them upbeat, but I also want to give us kind of a clear picture as to who these people are that are shaping our culture and our politics. So you're not going to find a slant one way or the other. It's going to be really through the eyes of the characters we're portraying. So I know the Kamala Harris one, for instance, I put it in first person and tried to really research how she spoke and watched lots of videos on picking up her cadence and things like that. So a lot of research goes into these 24 odd pages for these comics. It takes 6 to 8 months of research just before I even start working on the script. And then the artist comes in and really changes the narrative sometimes based on, you know, the beauty of the pages. So a lot of love goes into this, but a lot of positivity and hopefulness, I think, go into them too. And I really found them both exciting to work on. I think Joe Biden is a fantastic pick for today. We needed him. We needed kind of his oh shucks, optimism, his forcefulness too, is never backing down. There was something about that really appealed to me as a writer. And for Kamala Harris, it was the same thing. I think they complement each other fairly well. I guess the next, 100 days are really going to show us that.
Yes, absolutely. You have said numerous times during this interview that we shouldn't think of this as a political book.
Right.
We should think of it as a profile of two people who are influential in our political system. Do you think these latest two comic books in this series will be used in our education system?
Oh, that is the hope. I know that a lot of libraries and schools read these comics. I get lots of letters from kids that say that they've read some of them and they really enjoy them. And that's really what we hope, is that we're going to teach people a little bit more about the politicians that we see in the news every day. And I certainly hope that kids read it and schools use them.
Thanks to Tidal Wave Comics' Michael Frizzell, author of Political Power, President Joe Biden, and Political Power, Madam Vice President Kamala Harris, for joining our Kelly Steele on this week's Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we highlight student work from our youth media program at Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. From time to time on The Green, we like to highlight work from student journalists at both the high school and college levels. Delaware Public Media partners with McCain and Mount Pleasant High Schools in the Red Clay and Brandywine School Districts to expose students there to radio journalism. Delaware Public Media reporter and youth media producer Sophia Schmidt leads that collaboration for us. And this week, in Enlighten Me, we bring you two stories from students in the radio career pathway at Mount Pleasant about ways life has changed during the pandemic. For example, businesses have faced incredible obstacles to continue operating during the coronavirus pandemic. Over the past few months, that's included operating at 30% capacity for in-person dining, a level that can make staying afloat difficult. But WMPH staffer, Senior Liam Utes, reports some businesses are making do.
Restaurants can be a place to spend much-needed time with family, but with the COVID-19 pandemic, it's been harder than ever. Chris Morris is a manager at Mr. Pasta, which is a restaurant in Claymont that specializes in make-at-home meal kits. They say business for the restaurant has been going well.
We've actually been doing very well. Since we already had the cook-at-home established, at the beginning of the pandemic, we actually sold a lot of food. It's died down, but we're still doing fine. We're doing about as much business as we did pre-pandemic.
Morris says that they are a family-owned restaurant, so they are grateful for the good business. Fidel is a manager at Pat's Pizzeria, a restaurant on Philadelphia Pike with 50 locations around the East Coast. They say that they strictly follow the public health guidelines.
Well, we make sure that, we follow the guidelines of the state. You know, make sure everybody's wearing masks, make sure that we have gloves on and, washing our hands and, make sure that everybody's 6 feet apart, how we organize the tables and stuff like that. So whatever the guidelines the state offers, we follow that to the T.
The indoor capacity restriction does not affect takeout and deliveries. Fidel says the restaurant still gets many of these types of orders. For restaurants that aren't doing as well, we can hope that the restaurant business finds a resurgence after the coronavirus has passed. Liam, WMPH News.
Thanks to Mount Pleasant High School senior Liam Utes for that piece. We now hear from another WMPH staffer, Junior Sage Duarte. The COVID-19 pandemic has made it unsafe for many volunteers to do the work they usually do, and Sage examines how the pandemic is changing what volunteering looks like and how people can volunteer safely.
Since the start of COVID-19, volunteering has had to change. Safety precautions have to be taken into consideration, as well as how comfortable the volunteers feel going out. Some may feel it's a risk not worth taking. However, students still need volunteering hours for education programs, and organizations now more than ever are in need of assistance. According to a study conducted by Fidelity Charitable, an independent public charity and the nation's largest grant maker, the number of volunteers since the pandemic has decreased drastically, with 2 in 3 volunteers decreasing or stopping their volunteer work. That's also true in Delaware. Whilst some organizations have adapted well to the restrictions of the pandemic, others are in great need of volunteers and could use all the help they can get. Keith Hassett is the Community Engagement and Volunteer Manager at the Delaware Humane Association. He says they provide for the needs of stray dogs and cats, but also for those who have found homes.
We have low-cost vaccination clinics once a month. we have a pet food pantry. So if somebody has fallen on hard times and they can't afford pet food, they can come to us and we'll give them either dog or cat food, just enough to keep them in their home for another month. And if they still need it after 30 days, they can come back again and get more food.
According to Keith, the Delaware Humane Association has stopped taking volunteers due to the pandemic for safety reasons, and for now, rely on staff.
We are, unfortunately, not really doing much with volunteers right now. In fact, this past Sunday was our last event for volunteers, and we did that only because it was outdoors. But right now, we're not. The volunteers are coming in only because of the COVID crisis that we're having. We need to keep our staff healthy and our animals healthy, and we need to keep our own little bubble, if you will.
For the Delaware Humane Association, volunteers are not needed at the shelter. However, this doesn't necessarily mean you can't help them.
We have a wish list on our website. We also have an Amazon wish list. You can look for things that you can make on YouTube and then sell them or just bring them to us, because we could give our cats and dogs the toys. Basically, what people usually do to help support us is they'll just have like a food drive or a blanket drive. We could always use blankets and towels. That's always a big help too.
The volunteering may not look the same as it used to, but it still helps the DHA. Another organization that's adapted well to the pandemic is the Delaware Nature Society. The group works to connect people with the natural world and improve the environment through education, conservation, and advocacy. Aaron DeGennaro, the public program and summer camp coordinator, says there's something for everyone. They offer many programs, such as Mommy and Me programs, different teen programs, and even adult programs. They also offer volunteering opportunities.
We do have, like, volunteer days. So we also have, like, specific days that need volunteers, and those can be found on our website.
However, what's offered on the website is not the full extent of what's offered at the Delaware Nature Society. With the help of staff, you can find what volunteering may be the best fit for you.
We kind of like to talk to volunteers before they come in and just pick something. We kind of like to see what we need at the moment and then kind of work with them to see what they want to do to kind of find the best fit for them.
From what Aaron described, volunteers were lost amid the pandemic, but not entirely.
With our programming, you know, we have to kind of switch gears and change up what we're doing. I manage our volunteer counselors for the summer, so I'll speak to that. We were fine, but we did have a few less than we would have.
Whilst both the DHA and Delaware Nature Society haven't had too much trouble with a loss in volunteering, the same cannot be said with organizations such as the Blood Bank of Delmarva. The Blood Bank of Delmarva is a nonprofit that provides blood and blood products to 19 hospitals on the Delmarva Peninsula. Because of the pandemic, the blood supply has dropped to dangerously low levels, and the need for donors is now more urgent than ever. Angela Williamson is the Blood Bank's volunteer and community relations specialist. She described the importance of the situation.
So if you can imagine, let's just say for easy numbers, we had 100 donations coming in. 25 of those would have been coming from high schools or colleges. That is gone. So 25% of all of our donations are gone because we are not having very many mobile drives. So a quarter of our donors are not coming. But that it is really crucial to have those donors. And so we need 350 donors every single day in Delmarva to be able to supply the blood we need to our local hospitals.
There are requirements to meet in order to be a donor. And unfortunately for underclassmen students, you must be 17 years old to donate blood. However, there's more to volunteering at the blood bank than giving blood.
We have a lot of different roles for volunteers. In fact, we have right now a need for volunteers to be greeters at the front door. Greeters take temperatures, they clean tablets, they thank donors on their way out. We have volunteers that are in our refreshment area where donors sit and have their snacks after they've donated.
I always get apple juice. They still have that?
Yes.
All right, that'll be good, and I'll have some water.
As an organization that revolves around gathering blood, the Blood Bank of Delmarva has always taken cautious safety measures and been big about sanitation. With the pandemic, nothing has changed if not for more sanitation and social distancing.
Perfect. Can I take your temperature?
Yeah, absolutely, sure.
Awesome. Yeah, you're great.
Thanks.
With the pandemic, nothing has changed if not for more sanitation and social distancing. However, everyone's situation and risk level differs. For those who can't volunteer in person, there are online opportunities that allow you to help from the comfort of your home. Websites such as volunteer.delaware.gov offer remote volunteering opportunities for students who want to contribute to the community but don't feel safe to do in-person volunteering. Volunteering has changed with the times. With a pandemic, a good amount of volunteers have been lost. But there's something for everyone, and volunteering is no different. There's a wide variety of organizations in need of volunteers and could always use a helping hand. Sage, WMPH News.
Thanks to Mount Pleasant High junior Sage Duarte and senior Liam Utes for enlightening us this week. A reminder that stories like these are part of Delaware Public Media's collaboration with the Brandywine School District at Mount Pleasant High School and its radio station WMPH, as well as Red Clay School District at McCain High School and its radio station WMHS. Our youth media producer Sophia Schmidt oversees this collaboration and worked on pieces like these with teacher Paul Wishengrat, who runs the career pathway we work with at Mount Pleasant High. And that'll do it for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Mount Pleasant High School students Sage Duarte and Liam Utes, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Schellino, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. We'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.